Now, we were speaking yesterday about St. Augustine, and we mentioned under A the importance of St. Augustine. And the study of St. Augustine, it can be very important for a number of reasons, so many that in a way I wish we could spend a whole semester just on St. Augustine. Now, the reasons for this are not only because he was an extremely able man, one of the most able men in history. But there's many an extremely able man in history whom we would not profit greatly by studying at tremendous length. He is not only an extremely able man, but he has left us more writing than any other man from antiquity except Jerome and Origen. And, well, I don't know whether as much of Origen has been preserved as has been preserved of Augustine. Perhaps Origen actually wrote more, but it was somewhat earlier, and I believe there's more, much more preserved of Augustine than of Origen. And Jerome, a good bit, has been preserved, but he was a much greater thinker than either Origen or Jerome. And so what he wrote is of greater interest to us, though their works are of very great interest. But not only that, I think it is particularly important that he was a man, a practical man. Now, Origen and Jerome were very great scholars. Augustine was a scholar, and a good scholar, but not a great scholar. But Augustine was concerned with practical affairs in a way beyond what Origen or Jerome ever were. And so his writings give us contact with many more phases of life than theirs do, even though theirs may give us more brilliant speculative thinking in certain particular areas. But then another thing is that Origen and Jerome both had a Christian background, and they stepped out as people with a Christian background, stepping into a world in which they saw the great importance of Christian scholarship and made tremendous addition to it. But Augustine was a man who for 32 years was mixed up with the affairs of this world in one way or another, and who had a tumultuous experience of conversion, and who had therefore a realization of the grace of God that is perhaps beyond what would be realized by men who were like Origen, brought up in a Christian background, simply naturally looked to his father, the martyr, as a great hero who stood for the faith and wanted to stand for it in his life, but he didn't personally have as much of a realization of the forces of evil and of their various aspects and the ways in which they can be effective and the tremendousness of the grace of God that could deliver a man from them. So this background of Augustine, while that does not make him a greater man than either of these, or a greater Christian than either of these, it does mean that in his works we find certain things that we can perhaps profit more from the study of than we can from the similar things in the writings of these other two. Now, there may have been others in antiquity who were just as important in these regards as Augustine, but they've left us comparatively little in the way of writing. He has left this tremendous amount in the way of writing that he did. Then Augustine's experience was not in a period of persecution like Origen, in which there would be great, terrible situations to face which are so tremendous that they overshadow everything else. And consequently, other things are more or less forgotten in the face of these tremendous unusual circumstances the man has to face. Augustine faced some very unusual circumstances, but he faced the usual things that any Christian worker is going to have to face. And he never turned his back on any problem. He always did his best to deal with it. And so we have a variety in his life experience, a variety of contact with many, many different phases of life, such as you do not find in any other ancient writer. Then, however, we must say this, that Augustine, like all other human beings, was human. And Augustine was not perfectly sanctified. And every one of us, the effects of sin have affected our minds and our understanding. And we make mistakes. And while Augustine had a more brilliant mind than most people in history have had, and perhaps made the right decisions on details far more often than most people do, and on big issues made right decisions perhaps more often than other people do. When he made a wrong decision, it really did harm. He was so great a man that the tendency of most students is to think that anything he decided was right. I think that is a wrong approach. I feel that one of the great decisions of Augustine's life was a very wrong decision, was a harmful decision which did great injury to the cause of Christ then and on through the ages. And I feel that the attitude of his, which led him to make this wrong decision, affected certain other matters in which he did a great deal of good, but in fact, but where harm also came from, and where if he had more clearly seen the Lord's will, this harm would have been avoided. Thus you see why there are many, many reasons why a careful study of Augustine's life would perhaps yield results superior to that of anything we could do in the study of any other mere human being in ancient times. And perhaps beyond what we could get from the study of any human mere human being in modern times. The only men I would think of to put in the same category would be Luther and Calvin. But in the case of Luther and Calvin, we have in both of their cases, we have the great Reformation with the stand against that great apostasy and with the persecuting force of those who wish to destroy them. We have forces which are different from what we have today, which were so tremendous that they overshadow their life so much that though there's no limit to the good you could get from the study of the lives of Luther and Calvin, yet in the case of Augustine, it perhaps has more contact with ordinary life than Luther or Calvin. So it might be of value even beyond the study of Luther and Calvin. Now, I hesitate to say this because they're so tremendously important. Well, now, after saying all that, and then we only take a couple of hours dealing with him, it is sad to have to do that. But that's all we can do in the course of our year. But I want to try to have us get some of the main facts about Augustine and a few of the most important lessons from his life. And I hope that you can get such an introduction to him as will lead you eventually to read some of his great writings and to get value from it. We will assign some now. And you probably won't have time to do much with any more during your seminary course. But I hope that you will eventually find time to take some of his writings and make some real study of them for yourself. I think you'll find it very valuable. But now we look at B. Capital B is Augustine's early life. And one of the assignments that I gave you some time ago, which some of you were to complete, two-thirds of you before the vacation, one-third is due this week, that was the assignment in reading the first part of Augustine's Confessions. And these confessions are our primary source of knowledge about Augustine's early life. In addition to that, though, there were some lives of Augustine written by friends or students of his after his death. So you see, we have practically no contemporary evidence. Well, that's true of most great men. If you want to write a careful, full study of the first 30 years of Abraham Lincoln, you will find you have a tough job on your hands. There are myths and legends that have grown up about the early life of Abraham Lincoln. Because nobody thought that this poor young backwoodsman there in Kentucky was a man who was going to be so important that hundreds of books would be written about him eventually. And so they didn't think as a young man, when he was a young man there, of trying to watch everything he did and get the facts exactly right. And we know things he told friends, things he said himself later, and we gather things together, and different writers gather them in different ways. And we have quite a variety of opinions on some of the details of the early life of almost any great man who was not in surroundings of great wealth and culture while he was a young man. So that the early life of Augustine, we have to is not one of the things we know most about. Now, of course, we do have his Confessions. Now, that name, Confessions, is to the present day reader, it does not give you a real idea of what the book is. The Confessions of St. Augustine is really the autobiography of Augustine, written when he was about 40 years of age and looking back to his early life. But looking back to it not to satisfy the curiosity of other people as to how he lived, but looking back in order to praise God for the way that God worked in his life and for the way God blessed him and for the way God interfered miraculously in order to bring him to himself. And so when he speaks of how he stole an orange once when he was a boy or some piece of fruit and how bad he feels about it now and different things, why, we can draw the conclusion from it, though he was a sinner, as we all are, as a young man, he was not a man whom the world would think of as a wicked man, as a young man. He was a man whose natural taste ran toward intellectual matters and toward a generally substantial type of life. He was that. That was his background. That was what he was brought up in. And the one who, from a life of utter debauchery and utter selfishness and wickedness, is converted to the Lord and then becomes a great Christian leader, they are comparatively very few. But Paul, St. Paul, is a similar example. When he thought of his early life, which compared to the average man of his day was probably rather exemplary, but when he compared it with the standards that God has for us, he said he was indeed the chief of sinners. He deserved nothing good at God's hand. It was only God's marvelous grace that brought him to himself. And so the more we really understand God's standards of righteousness, the more we realize how little we deserve at his hand, and the more terrible our sin appears to us to be. And, of course, in God's standards are entirely different from human standards. But from human standards, Augustine was doubtless a good, substantial, orderly young man. But he was a sinner, and he realized, as particularly looking back after 40 years, he realized that he had been far short of God's desire for him. And so his confessions are really his book of praise to God for his blessing to a man who deserved no good at the hands of God. That's what it really is. But he starts in with his early life, and he tells us about it. He does not go into geographical and historical details, which we need to know to understand it. He was born in a little town in North Africa called Tagaste, T-A-G-A-S-T-E. I believe sometimes they put an H after the first T, but while they don't pronounce it, it isn't really particularly important which way we spell it. T-A-G-A-S-T-E. Now, in this little town of Tagaste, there was a man, what we would call him, of the middle class, and not wealthy at all, but fairly well off. And this man was a pagan. But he had a wife who was a Christian, and who may have been a Christian background for two or three generations. We don't know a great deal about her. Her name was Monica. And her name is known to everyone who's ever been in California any month, because after Augustine's mother, a coast town in California takes its name. But Monica had three children, a daughter and two sons. And we know practically nothing about the other two children, except that there were these two children. But Augustine himself always felt that his mother wanted him to be a Christian, but he felt that his father didn't care whether he was or not. His father only wanted him to be a substantial citizen. And it's as he gets older that he begins to realize his mother's tremendous desire that he become a Christian. And in his, some writers even try to make it out that his mother was rather indifferent in his early life, but I think that's truly a guess. We know that she was by the time he was 20, she was tremendously interested in her son becoming a Christian. He had attended Christian services as a young man, or as a child, I mean. He had attended Christian services, and possibly there he got an interest and a desire to know what was right but not a deep, real understanding of the things of God. And as he got older, he had a problem in his mind. What is the real meaning of the universe? What is the truth? It is vital that I should learn it. But he didn't feel that he reached it until he was 32 years of age. Now, as a young fellow, at 12 years of age, he was sent off to a school where he would study Latin writing and Latin classics. And he profited greatly by that. He doesn't seem to have enjoyed the Greek so much. He never became a real Greek scholar, though he learned some Greek. But then at, about the age of 18, he came back to Tagaste, and they got him further instruction there, and then they sent him on to Carthage to study. Now, all this happens in North Africa. And North Africa, we're apt to think of as a very backward region. And as a matter of fact, it probably has been a very backward region ever since 430 A.D., ever since approximately the time when Augustine died. But during the previous few centuries, it had been one of the outstanding provinces of the Roman Empire. When you think of the great leaders of the early Christian church, if you name 20 great leaders, if anybody were to name 20 great leaders of the early Christian church, I do not think he could possibly fail to include in that list Tertullian, Cyprian, and Augustine. And for three of them to come from this province of North Africa shows you how important North Africa was as a part of the world in those days. Now, in North Africa here, there had been some settlers from Tyre, from the ancient city of Tyre, who had come there I don't know how many centuries before the time of Christ, and had founded the city of Carthage. And the word Carthage is the Punic. It's a language closely related to Hebrew, the Punic for the new town. And these people formed their new town there, and it became perhaps the greatest port on the Mediterranean Sea. And for a time, Carthage became a great center, which looked as if it would become eventually mistress of the world. And then the little upstart town of Rome in southern Italy resisted the progress of Carthage and began to interfere with Carthage's trade, and eventually it came to three great wars between the Romans and the Carthaginians, in which the fate of Rome hung in the balance for a time. But eventually the Romans won out, and winning out, they completely destroyed the city of Carthage, burned it, killed everybody, or sent them into slavery. But there were left, of course, the people with the Punic background in the neighborhood, out through the country. The Punic Wars were between 250 and 100 B.C. I don't know the exact date, but or at least not earlier than 300. I don't recall the exact date. But this is long before our present period. They are very important in Roman history because they determined that Rome became a great power. But after that, about 20 years after, Rome sent some colonists there to form a new town, a Roman town, on the ruins of Carthage. And this town grew up, and many Romans migrated there, and North Africa was a truly Latin center, but the great mass of the country population would be Punic background. That is, the background related to the ancient people of Tyre, and as their common language, speaking a language somewhat similar to Hebrew. But the official language was Latin, the language of the cities was Latin, and there were enough Roman influence, enough Roman people there, that it was one of the great provinces of the Roman Empire. During the early centuries of the Christian era, Rome did not pay a great deal of attention to this area. They collected very considerable tax from it. They received great amounts of food that were produced there. Roman soldiers were there on the mountains a few miles to the south, watching against the incursion of wild tribes from further south. Occasionally, some of these marauders would get through and pillage a section of the area, but ordinarily, the Roman soldiers held them back. And with this Roman protection from the south and the sea to the north, it was one of the most fertile, fruitful, and in general, well-to-do regions of the Roman Empire. People often speak, though, of the hot African temperament. Now, whether they are referring to the original people of this area who had been conquered by the Carthaginians, or how many of them there were, we don't know, or whether they are the people from Tyre and the background from there. But at any rate, it would seem that there is a restlessness. There is somewhat more free from restraint than the people of Italy itself at that time. And somewhat more tempestuous in the expression of their emotion and their attitude. But it was, on the whole, a very orderly section, except for these outbursts of feeling on the part of individuals or small groups. It was an orderly section of the Roman Empire, a well-to-do section, a section which was very much a center of Latin learning. Now, back in those days, in the Roman Empire, perhaps the greatest ability a person could get would be to be a rhetorician. They had no TV then. They did not have a great many of the amusements we have today. And they didn't have newspapers that were widely distributed. And so matters in the local councils or in the provincial councils or in the councils of the empire were apt to be decided to quite an extent by the eloquence and the ability and reasoning of those who supported them. And so rhetoric had a position which it has not had now for at least a century. It had, I guess, in the early days of the United States. And a person who was a good speaker would command tremendous praise and could make tremendous money. And so Augustine's parents urged that he become a rhetorician. He had thought of being a lawyer. He never went far enough with his legal studies to become a lawyer, but he became a teacher of rhetoric. And so he taught rhetoric in his little town of Sagasti for a little. He taught rhetoric in Carthage. And during this period, he was interested in finding what is the true meaning of life. And there were a number of so-called churches in North Africa which belonged to a group known as the Manichaeans. Now, I've asked you a number of times to name the three great movements, opponents of Christianity in the 3rd century. And as you all remember, one of them is the Manichaeans. Followers nominally of Mani, a Persian, but having a belief which was greatly affected by at least the externalities of Christianity, and greatly affected by the Gnostic heresies of the 2nd century. And Manichaeanism was a movement which had 12 apostles and which had a worldwide organization, which had churches somewhat similar to Christian churches, with services quite similar to Christian services, and which claimed to have the interpretation of the problem of life. And they had a considerable number of followers. And for 9 years, Augustine rather faithfully attended Manichaean service and took a great interest in their thought and in their outlook. So I want to remind you just a little of the Manichaean viewpoint. They thought that there are two great forces in the world. There is the force of light and the force of darkness. And these two are opposite. The force of light, the force of good, the force of darkness, the force of evil. And the good forces created the world and created man, but the evil forces have tried to take over. And it is a tough struggle between the two. And matter tends to be evil. Meat is evil. The pleasures of life are mostly evil, all except one. It so happens that as vegetation grows, light is trying to get away from this earth, which the forces of darkness have taken over, but is caught by the branches and held in them and gets into the fruit. And so if you eat fruit, you liberate some of this light. So it's a good thing. So you can eat as much fruit as you want, the fruit or vegetation as you want, but when you enjoy meat or when you enjoy things that are not specifically grown on trees or bushes, why, you are then perhaps getting yourself involved with the evil force. Now, the Manichaeans had what they called the elect. There were a few people in each of their churches recognized as the elect. They were the ones who were living a truly a life, truly in line with the forces of light. And they were supposed to be very ascetic. And Augustine found that some of them were hypocrites. And this offended him. You will find that in any group anywhere, unfortunately. But he was affected by finding it there among them. What bothered him still more than that was that he found certain questions about the universe and about the meaning of life that their answers seemed to him rather contradictory or inconsistent. And he began asking questions. And the leaders of the church there, unable to answer the questions of this very thoughtful teacher of rhetoric, said, well, they said, Faustus, one of our great bishops, is going to pay us a visit for the next couple of years. And he'll know how to answer all your questions. He really knows. So Augustine looked forward for a couple of years to the coming of Faustus, and he would get all his questions answered. And when Faustus came, he found that Faustus was a man with a nice personality and a pleasant way of talking who knew less than the people actually there did. And that was a great disappointment to Augustine, but it broke the back of his interest in Manichaeanism. He became a good personal friend of Faustus and found him a very nice fellow to have association with, but certainly not a man who knew as much as he did, and certainly not one who could answer his question. So 9 years he spent part of his time going to Manichaean services, and he persuaded a number of his friends to go to Manichaean services. But in the course of this, eventually he was completely disillusioned with it. And as he tells us in his confessions, all this time his mother was praying that he would leave the Manichaeans and would become a Catholic Christian, that he would become truly a member of the Christian Church and would not follow in this false way. And as he tells about her, he says, could the prayers of such a mother carried on so steadily and so fervently, could God disregard such prayers? Well, when he turned away from that, he then continued to be inquiring and seeking, but he had one problem, a problem which perhaps isn't so easy for us to understand today, to fully understand, because our customs are very different from those in those days. In the Roman Empire, they had very lax attitudes towards sex, extremely lax. And the result of these extremely lax attitudes, one result was that Christians like Origen and Jerome reacted in an extreme ascetic direction, as we've noted. And so there are the two extremes in the Roman Empire then, in a way which we have not yet seen them, though the way our world is going today, one wonders if we may not, if the Lord tarries, get a similar development yet. But as of the present, we have not had a development similar to what was then in that regard. But there were many slaves in North Africa. I remember reading about someone in the North African church at that time speaking to a young man who said he'd lived a very exemplary life. And they asked him, well, had he ever had illicit sex relations with virgins or other women, with women and so on? Well, he says, no, I've lived a very upright life in this regard. Oh, he says, except, of course, for the natural use of the slave women. Well, with such an attitude, as you can see, in the hot blood of North Africa, with this general attitude, Augustine, by the time he was 20, entered into what we today would call a common law marriage. But it was considered then as a relation of concubines. Yeah, there's no evidence he ever was what we would call promiscuous today. But he took this woman as his concubine. And from the time he was 20 until he was 30, yeah, she was always with him. And she bore him a son when he was very shortly after 20, to whom he gave the name Adiodatus, the gift of God. And the son seems to have been quite a brilliant young boy. Unfortunately, he died in his middle teens. But Augustine, when he went to Carthage and lived there for a time,
took this woman with her, and then he took her with him to Italy. But all the time, he felt that his relationship with her was wrong. And this was one thing that kept him away from Christianity, was his realization that Christianity would consider his relation with her as sinful and wrong. Well, in Carthage, he managed to turn some of his good friends who had gone crazy over the sports of the circus and the gladiatorial combats and that sort of thing. He won them away from it to a more serious, sober life. He was always interested in helping people to a better life, but he didn't yet really have a realization of what a better life should be. And he decided there'd be better opportunities as a teacher of rhetoric in Rome, and he moved to Rome, taking his concubine with him and some good friends of his going with him, because he had an influence on people even at this early age. And then in Rome, we don't know much about it. It would seem that things didn't pan out as he had hoped. And he had an opportunity to become a teacher of rhetoric in Milan. Now, Milan was at this time the governmental capital of Italy, even though Rome was the greatest city of the empire. Rome was the real headquarters, the real capital. But when it comes to governmental affairs, Milan was at this time the center. And he went to Milan, and there he went to the principal church and heard the preaching of St. Ambrose. And he was tremendously impressed with St. Ambrose. And we cannot say just how much of an effect St. Ambrose had over him, but he certainly had a very great effect. He listened to St. Ambrose's preaching. He was greatly interested in it. There were certain problems to which he didn't know the answer. He didn't find the answer as yet. He was interested in this. Then he met a very prominent Roman who told him about an important Roman senator who in his later life had become a Christian, and how he had witnessed boldly to his former associate, and Augustine was greatly affected and influenced by this, and evidently went through a time of very strong emotional difficulty of deciding what he ought to do, where the truth really was. He reached the point where he decided he should get rid of his concubine. He sent her back to Athens. And then his mother came to Milan, and she said, Augustine, she said, I see you can't live the way you are. You must become married. I will get you a wife. And so she found a young girl who was not yet old enough to marry. And she made the arrangement for her to become his wife, but he had to wait a year or two before he could do so because she was still too young. And so he went and took another concubine. And he felt he was doing wrong. He wanted to get away from it, but he didn't know how. And he had the experience which he describes in his confessions, which we'll call B, Augustine's conversion. He felt as if he was in the grip of forces that were too strong for him. He wanted to do what was right, but he felt that he couldn't. He simply could not turn his back on that which he felt he ought to. He simply could not turn away from wickedness, turn completely to Christianity, and then he had intellectual problems besides about it, but he just was wavering and wondering, and different things he tells about in his confessions came in to influence him. And when he was in this situation, he was talking with someone. He got all upset one day, and he rushed out into the garden. And there out in the garden, he heard a voice which said, take, read, take, read. And as he heard this voice saying, tole, lege, take, read, take, read. He said, what's this voice anyway? He said, is this children in the next yard playing a game? Well, what game would they play where they say, take, read, take, read? He pondered over it in his later life. Where could the voice have come from? Was it children saying, calling something out in the middle of a game? Why would they call those words? He didn't know. But he felt as if it was a message from God to him. Take and read. And he picked up the Bible and he opened it at random. and he read in the book of Romans, put you on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. And he said, this is God's message for me. He said, put on the Lord Jesus Christ. Take the step of faith. Receive him into your heart and then leave it to him to take care of the lusts of the flesh that you can't, you haven't got the strength to handle. And he graded his conversion from that point. And so Augustine's conversion made an impression on the whole of his later life, that it was the grace of God alone, that except for the grace of God he would be lost, that there was nothing he could have done, but that God had entered in most marvelously and had turned him from darkness to light. Now there are myths that have grown up, such as he was there now when Ambrose resisted the efforts of the empress to have one of the churches turned over to the Arians, to have Arian services for the mercenary soldiers in the land. And they had all those times of excitement, and he lived through some of those experiences. And there is a myth that he and Ambrose together sang the Te Deum, the Praise God, which has been sung ever since in churches all over Europe, that it originated from these two men extemporaneously singing this in unison. It probably are merely stories of a later age. But Augustine himself evidently had money enough by this time that he could retire to a country place with a few friends and discuss philosophical questions. And so he retired with them, and he was amazed at the brilliance of his boy, Adeodatus, the young boy in his early teens, and how clearly he saw through various questions. And they discussed various things, and they had written down what they said. And Augustine began, he was interested in looking into all kinds of questions and finding the answers. They discussed things there. He stayed there another year or two, and then he decided to go back to Africa. And he one of his best friends, who had been more or less followed him through all these steps, and his son and his mother went south to Rome and then went to the seaport of Rome to take ship for Africa. And his mother died there rather suddenly. And so his mother died there at Ostia, and he went on to Africa. And there in Africa, he took the estate that his father had left him. His father, toward the very end of his life, had made a Christian profession. But his father had died some years before this. He took the estate and he sold them. And with the money from them, he was retired to a little country place where he, with a few friends, tried to discuss questions and write down everything they said and tried to find the answers to these questions. And he decided to live a contemplative life, studying the scripture and the things of the Lord. But forces that, beyond his control, interfered with it. And so we look on to see Augustine as bishop. Well, perhaps that title, Augustinus Bishop, that's covering a lot in one heading. D, rather. Thank you. Augustine as bishop. And C was Augustine's conversion. And D, I'm calling Augustine as bishop. And here we will glance at the day-to-day activities. First, we will see how he came to become a bishop. He had no thought of becoming a bishop. He had no thought of entering into a position in the church. Are you raising your hand? Yes. What is it?
You mentioned that he retired to a country place for a year or so and discussed the things. And then you mentioned that he went back to Africa now. Then
in Africa, he sold his father's property and got this little country place where he began further having discussions with friends.
Further discussions?
Yeah.
He did it twice.
He did this up near Milan. He did it again down there. But in North Africa there, the story had been heard about how Ambrose became Bishop of Milan. You remember how he did? How he, was the Roman governor there when the people couldn't agree who should be their bishop, and he was there with the soldiers to preserve order and keep the two groups from fighting each other in the church as they discussed who should be their bishop. And when they couldn't agree, somebody had the impression it was a child's voice said, make Ambrose bishop. And they all joined together. Ambrose should be bishop. And Ambrose, in response to the call of the people, left the service of the state and became the Bishop of Milan and one of the great leaders of the early Christian church. Well, in Africa, people had the impression, if we think a man is the right man to be our leader, we should simply call upon him. And he can't resist. He's got to do what we call him to do. And this was often done in these days in North Africa. Now Augustine didn't want anything like this to happen, so he stayed pretty close to the place where he's having his discussion. But there was a little town called Hippo, H-I-P-P-O. Hippo was a port. It had a good port on the shores of the Mediterranean. There's a town there today called Bona, B-O-N-A. But Hippo, quite a distance west of Carthage, on the coast there, was a town, bigger town than Tagaste, where he had been brought up, but a small place in comparison with Carthage, of course. And here at Hippo, there was a large Manichaean church, and there was a large Donatist church, and there was a rather small Catholic church. As you know, the word Catholic in those days meant all-embracing. Catholic was used of those churches which had relations with one another throughout the empire. The largest church in North Africa was the Donatist church. They had more people than the Catholic church had, but they had no relations. They were not recognized by any of the churches outside of Africa, outside of North Africa. And North Africa was called Africa by the Romans. The smaller Catholic church had relations with the churches in Italy and in Egypt and in Syria and in other countries, and it was called the Catholic Church. Well, the Catholic Church in Hippo had a Greek bishop, and he was rather elderly. And some of his people decided to help him out. He was getting elderly, he needed assistance, he couldn't carry on the work properly as he should carry it on, and so the people, sent word to Augustine. And they said, Augustine, the Manichaeans are making inroads in our church. Their church is growing here in Hippo, and we can't answer their arguments. And we know you've had much experience with the Manichaeans. Do come and give us some help against this Manichaean problem. And Augustine didn't know how he could answer how he could turn down a need like that. So he came. And he got to Hippo, and he gave them advice dealing with the Manichaeans and so on. And then he went to the church service, and the bishop, in the course of his sermon, said, I am getting old, and I can't carry on the work as I should. I ought to have a presbyter to assist me. I have no presbyter. I should have a presbyter to assist me. Won't you people pray that God will send a presbyter to assist me? And he went on like this for a while, and then the people called out, make Augustine presbyter, make Augustine presbyter. And Augustine was on the spot there. And he was on the spot, and they said, this is the Lord's call to you, you've got to accept it. It's the last thing in the world he wanted to do. But he couldn't say no. So Augustine became the presbyter there. He went back to the other place, and he closed up his country place, sold it off, and moved to Hippo and became the assistant pastor, or the presbyter, as they call it. Augustine now was presbyter, and he did a part of the preaching. He did much of the work there. He made plans for fighting the Manichaeans and eventually for fighting the Donatists. And he was very active in the church, and people began to hear about him. And they had a big meeting of pastors from all over North Africa, which happened to meet in Hippo, and they asked Augustine to give a talk to them. And then the people of Hippo began to get frightened. They said, now Augustine's getting known all through North Africa. Some other church is going to call him to be their bishop. And so Valerius, the bishop, persuaded the leading bishop in that section of Africa, which was called Numidia, to come there and to ordain Augustine as auxiliary bishop along with him, with the idea that he would succeed him as bishop. Now later on, they found that the Council of Nicaea had taken an action forbidding such appointment, that there should be only one bishop in a town, there should not be auxiliary bishops, and that when a man was bishop in one place, he should stay there. He shouldn't become bishop in any other place. But they didn't know about this. They didn't bother to look it up, I guess. And they didn't know it. Maybe they didn't have a copy of the canons of the Council of Nicaea. Anyway, Augustine was prevailed upon to accept the appointment, and the primate of Numidia ordained him as auxiliary bishop. And within a year, Valerius died. And so Augustine was the bishop of Hippo, which he remained for more than 30 years, until his death in 430. Now, as bishop, Augustine was engaged in all sorts of controversies at which we will look, but that doesn't mean he neglected the regular work of bishop. He had a tremendous job to do. He had his regular sermons to carry on. He had influence on the lives of the people, and he was trying to persuade the people to turn to an ascetic life, trying to persuade them to turn away from all worldly pleasure. And when somebody would come and say, Augustine, I want to live an ascetic life, to eat very little, to not have any worldly pleasures, to devote myself to studying the scripture and praying, Augustine was always ready to say, well, here, I've got another building out here on the property here where I have four people doing that. You join with them and you come. And if you have any money, you give it to me now and we'll give it to the poor so you won't have anything. We will just take care of you out of gifts that come in. And so Augustine was happy when somebody would do this. And soon he had quite a group there. But then he began to find some of them were escaped criminals, trying to escape from the law. And some of them gave him some money and kept most of what they had and hidden somewhere. And he ran into all kinds of difficulties in his handling of this. And he even publicly preached on how disappointed he was in the way that these men were turning out. But he was always hopeful that he would get a group of men who were really devoted to the Lord. And among them, there were individuals who he taught and who eventually became bishops of many of the churches in North Africa. And so you might say he ran a school, a sort of a school along with his work as bishop. Then he found many of the practices of the people that he didn't like. And they were certain feast days, certain days on which it was customary to have a great big feast, and half of them would get drunk. And he got after them and preached against it and persuaded them to give up these practices. And there were a number of different things like that. But he ran the risk of becoming very unpopular because of the way that he opposed practices and actions of the church that had developed over a long period of time, but that he felt were wrong. And then it was in these days, the Roman Empire was favoring the Christian church, and if a man was accused of a crime, if the man declared he was a member of the church, it was quite common that the court would say, well, let the pastor decide. And so he had very often to hold what they called the bishop's court, and to make his decision as to the rightness or the wrongness of the charges made against people. He had a very active, busy life as a bishop of the town of Hippo. And as we read about it and about his actions, we find all sorts of things that have contact with problems we will meet today. And so this is a phase of Augustine's life that has no parallel in that of Origen or of Jerome, for instance. Now, I'll mention as E, Augustine's Confessions. I've already spoken about this, but this book is perhaps one of the best known. If you would name the 50 best known books in the world, I imagine Augustine's Confessions would be one of them. Many people who know nothing else about Augustine have heard of Augustine's Confessions. It's the best known of his writings. It's a book which has had a great influence. And it was when he was about 40, about 8 years after his conversion. He'd just been a few years in Hippo when he sat down to write his confession, his survey of his life, expressed as a prayer to God and praise to God for what God had done in his life. Then F, we'll call the Manichaean controversy. While Augustine was still a presbyter, before he'd been very long at Hippo,
Augustine set to work to try to stop the people being lost to the Manichaeans, and in fact to win some of the Manichaeans. And he began to, he challenged the head of the Manichaean church to a debate. And they held the debate, and he very evidently, completely defeated the man in the debate. And the people from the Donatist church came also to see it. And they were thrilled with the way Augustine was defeating the Manichaeans. And the Donatists were very proud of Augustine and what he was doing. And for the rest of his life, off and on, he wrote articles against the Manichaeans, particularly during these first 10 years there. He wrote many articles and some books against the Manichaeans, showing that their idea of the force of the evil force and the good force struggling is not the truth, that there is a sovereign God who established all things for his good purpose. And though God did not want to make us automata, that he'd press a button, we do this or that, he wanted us to have a will and a mind. He wanted us to follow him because he loved us, not because he pressed a button and we went that way like an automobile. And that once you have this, you have the possibility that man will go the other way. You have the possibility of sin. And so sin is not something that God is the author of, not something that God wills, but something that is necessary if that is the possibility of sin, if God is going to have individuals, persons, not just machines. And that sin is a terrible thing, but it is not the other great force in the universe, as the Manichaeans tell. And so he had great controversy with the Manichaeans, and while the Manichaeans continued for centuries, their force was probably cut at least in half, maybe to a third, by his efforts. Well, I see we'll have to continue tomorrow at this point.